Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Going to begin this morning with some music from Luca Bloom. Good morning, Luca Bloom.
Lovely to see you, Miriam.
Brilliant. Good morning to you. You're going to start off this morning playing for us a song called Diamond Mountain You Rode. Tell me about it. My
first trip to Australia was in 1992, and while I was there, I was really struck, as I always am when I'm away, either in America or Australia, especially by the number of people who feel a connection not just with Ireland, but with a specific place in Ireland, because of a song. And I'm talking about people who've maybe never been to Ireland, but they have heard their parents or their grandparents sing songs about specific places. And it's a beautiful thing that songs can do. Songs do many things. They connect us to each other. They connect us to love. They make us dance. They make us sad. They make us cry. They make us happy. But there's another thing that songs can do, which is they can help someone to feel connected to a place they've never been. And that's why I wrote this song, kind of for people in Australia, about that whole thing of connecting to a place back in Ireland.
Beautiful. Okay, off you go, Luca, and you're going to sing for us now your own song, Diamond Mountain.
Voices cry out, shells of houses, white-faced children, hungry eyes. The cruel sea calls, the unwilling traveller who would look for the road to survival. Hold my hand a little longer, take one last look out over the fields to the reds and the browns on Diamond Mountain. Bring the smell and the sound to your station. I will be here when you need me. I will be here They bring their songline to Australia, scattering magical airs in cities and towns. The dreaming road to Diamond Mountain, an ordinary wonder. Hold my hand a little longer, take one last look out over the fields to the reds and the browns on Diamond Mountain. Bring the smell and the sound to your station. I will be here when you need me. I will be here in the pouring rain. I will be here on Diamond Mountain. Kisses his love on
Diamond Mountain, the mad wind whistles, bushes and stones, like two March swallows, back on the mountain, come full circle at last, heaven is home.
Beautiful song, Luca. You're going to go off now, have some breakfast in our canteen and come back later on and we'll have a chat and more music.
Thanks very much.
Well, I'm now joined in our studio by John Banville, who has in fact been called a literary institution all by himself. Writing under his own name, he's won the Man Booker Prize for his novel The Sea, but his career ranges from 1989's The Book of Evidence to Mrs. Osmond in 2017. Of course, he also writes as Benjamin Black, a vastly successful series of crime novels set in 1950s Ireland. And next month, John's going to be featuring at the Irish Literary Festival in Dublin in a talk with the Italian writer Roberto Colasso. Good morning, John Banville.
Good morning.
Sounds great, actually, all of that, doesn't it? All those books.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. Roberto Colasso is that rare thing nowadays, an unashamed intellectual.
Tell me a little about him, actually. I don't know much about Roberto Colasso. Is that a terrible thing to admit?
He is one of Europe's great scholars. He's also a practical man. He runs Adelphi Editions, a wonderful publishing house in Milan. He's a splendid individual, admirable and courageous.
The event itself, tell me a little about it. I gather you're discussing challenges to liberating and to a world that feels more elusive than ever. Is that correct?
Well, he has just published a book called The Unnameable Present, which is unusual for Roberto in that he's considering the burning issues of our time, the threats to democracy, the rise of populism, which is a nice way of putting it, the rise of fascism. I do think that I didn't live through the 1930s, but what I read of it feels very familiar to the time we're in now, so we have to be very, very careful indeed. I would worry greatly about next month's European elections. I think Europe is going to look very different after those elections. I think the rise of fundamentalist parties, and all, both right and the left, is a wonderful phrase in French, les extrêmes se touchent, which is the extremes touch at the back. You know, the right and the left are now, they seem to be indistinguishable. So it's a dangerous time. And that's what he's writing about in this book.
And yet, I suppose a lot of people around the world must feel disenfranchised, must feel very unhappy with their own lives, for them to vote for people like that. Do you agree with that? And
yeah.
How do you resolve that? Because they're underlying issues, aren't they?
Yes, of course. I was in America in 2016 for a month before the Trump election, a month afterwards. I knew for weeks beforehand he was going to win. The fury in America was palpable. You could feel it crackling in the air. People were going to vote for an extreme. Unfortunately, they voted for a billionaire whose only interest, he's representing the Republican Party, whose only interest is the interest of the rich, the extreme rich. And, you know, a tiny percentage of the world now controls almost all the wealth in the world. So people are voting against themselves. Their turkeys voting for Christmas. And they don't realise it. It's very sad. But they feel they're having their say.
But that's very bleak, is it not? I mean, shouldn't we all, John, for a better world where there is greater equality and less of a division between rich and poor?
Well, look, there's a very hopeful sign in this country. We're doing very well indeed. We've a good government. We voted for gay marriage. I was wandering around the city on the day that the vote was being counted for that. I thought, this is not the Ireland I grew up in. this is absolutely wonderful. I felt that that gay marriage vote was a collective apology for the horrors of the past. It wasn't going to do much for the poor people whose lives were destroyed, but at least it was an effort. So we again may become, as we are reputed to have been in medieval times, we may be a beacon of light in a darkening Europe. Isn't that a wonderful notion? Little yeah. Ireland.
It
again,
is.
We stand up and say, we have something to say.
Do you enjoy writing more today than you did decades ago, or does it get easier or harder?
It stays the same. Never gets easier.
Does it?
Language is such a deceptive opponent, and it is an opponent. I always think of myself as Jacob wrestling with the angel. Language deceives. Language wishes to speak. I often think that it's not so much that we speak, but that we are spoken. You know, you write a letter to your lover, your bank manager, and you read the letter and you think, that wasn't quite what I meant to say. Who's speaking here? It's not who, it's what. Language is speaking. So we always have to fight against it. It wants to do its own thing, whereas we have to force it into a different direction. It's a bit absolutely fascinating. I've said so many times now, it's becoming a stupid mantra with me, but the sentence is the greatest invention of humankind. We've never invented anything greater than that. There have been civilizations that didn't have the wheel, but they were civilization because they had a sentence. There's a wonderful story of Joyce, somebody saying to him, you know, Mr. Joyce, will you explain to me in a sentence what is Ulysses about? And he said, how long a sentence?
What's the longest you've ever spent working on a sentence?
Oh, I don't know, but I know that I spent about 3 months writing the first paragraph of a book. But look, it's delightful to work on a sentence. It's frustrating and it's difficult and sometimes it's painful, but it's also a great delight. I mean, what better way could I have expected to live my life than dealing with this fundamental invention of humankind, the sentence? It's a beautiful thing. We declare love in it. Our laws are graven in the sentence. This is what we are, is in the sentence. And I get to spend my life fiddling with it. It's wonderful.
Do you feel very lucky that it is what you do for a living?
I feel completely privileged, of course.
It's hard enough, though, because initially to make it, it's hard being a writer. It also can be quite a lonely career path, if that's what you call it. I mean, you're an artist.
Solitary, but solitude is different to loneliness. My head is peopled with people, invented people, so I'm never alone. But it is difficult, of course it is, but what's the point of doing easy things?
Do you remain very disciplined about writing or not?
Yes, of course. I still write 9:30, 10 o'clock till 6 in the evening, sometimes later. I have a little bread and cheese in the middle, but that's it. Of course I do, but discipline is wonderful. You know, my life is full. My greatest terror as a child, I remember, was the terror of boredom. And I'm still a child, of course, and I'm still terrified of boredom. And I'm never bored.
Which is an amazing thing to say, really, isn't it, in your life?
I am, as I said, extraordinarily fortunate. I am blessed by a secular god, the secular god of literature.
Were you upset by Notre Dame when you saw that? Did that move you or not?
I shed a tear and I wrote to two people who were close to me and they said, it'll be rebuilt in a few years, which is wonderful, except that it reminded me a bit of somebody talking to Napoleon, looking out over one of the battlefields, tens of thousands of dead, and he said, one night in Paris will replace all this. My daughter lives in Paris. Sent me one of these messages that they do, and she said, look, Notre Dame's on fire. Of course, immediately I thought, oh God, I hope it's not terrorism. At least it wasn't. It was just an act of God, good old God, burning one of his own places.
You don't believe in any religion, do you? Or do you?
Oh, well, I don't believe in an afterlife, and I don't believe in a personal God, but I agree with my friend, the English philosopher John Gray, who says that religion is a poetic interpretation of life, and I wouldn't be without it. I was thinking coming out here today, when I was a little boy, I was in the choir, it must have been the Christian Brothers choir, and we used to sing the Gloria at midnight mass at the end of Good Friday, the beginning of Holy Saturday. It was an extraordinary experience. I wouldn't have been without that. And then, of course, John the 23rd, Vatican II, destroyed the whole thing. But before that, the ritual was a glimpse of the beautiful possibilities of life. Not the afterlife, the beautiful possibilities of life. A little boy singing his heart out at midnight on Good Friday, Easter Saturday. I mean, isn't that a wonderful emblem?
It is.
I mean, when I was a child, what terrified me was the prospect of heaven. Hell I could deal with. But heaven would have all those awful people. Those bores, the schoolyard bully would be up there waiting for me, you know. My awful aunt, whom I hated, she'd be there waiting for me. It was hell, you know, all the good people were down there. But the very notion of eternity, of living forever, this was horrifying. I still would find it horrifying. Much better that we have this exquisite life that we have here, which is full of beauty and full of sorrows and terrors, but it is exquisite. We have it, it's very short, and it ends and we're gone. And other people come along and they do what we did, they make all our mistakes, but they, you know, they push civilization on just a little bit. That's a wonderful notion. Who needs heaven? This is heaven. This is hell.
The great thing about being a writer, though, is you can last forever because you, John Bamble, produce books that many regard as a work of art. So they will last after you.
Yes, of course. But, you know, even now, I have no sense of them existing in the world. I mean, they're gone. They're the only person in the world who can't read my books is me. Everybody else could, but I can't because I bring to them all the lumber that went into making them.
Are you writing a Benjamin Black or a John Bamble at the moment?
I'm writing a John Bamble.
Nearly finished?
No. I've started. And
how many paragraphs have you written?
I've written 4 or 5 pages. I started about a year and a half ago.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, it'll get done. I'll add a sentence every now and then. Eventually, one day, I'd say, well, I can't do any more with this, so I better give it up.
And you really never reread any of your books. Would you not be tempted to go back and read a book like The Sea from? You just wouldn't reread your books?
No, I'd be horrified because all I would see is the mistakes and the failures and the lack of the lack of nerve that Tuesday afternoon when I should have gone on and, you know, got that sentence as near to perfect as I could. So all I see are the
But
faults.
It won the Man Booker Prize. Would you not read it and go, that's great, John, well done?
No.
No.
Winning a prize, I mean, you'd be very foolish. You'd be a very poor writer if you imagined that winning a prize made any difference to your work. It's lovely getting a prize, but it's like being a child getting a big red toy fire engine, you know. It's Christmas ends and the new year comes and you have to start another book.
Before we close, do you enjoy Easter? Like, do you enjoy the celebration of Easter, Easter Sunday? Is it like Christmas? He looks at me strangely.
I detest Christmas.
Do you?
Oh, yeah. All that false
Santa Claus.
American Christmas is lovely. It's 2 days, and a half, and it's over. Here it goes on forever and ever and ever. And I get bored. And as I say, that's my greatest terror, you know. I think on Christmas morning, God Almighty, this day is going to last until midnight. What am I going to do? So I don't like festivals. I don't like holidays. I like my life. You only want holidays if you don't like your life.
That's interesting. I suppose it's a moment to pause or reflect.
Well, I mean, look, we always forget the seasons. You know, even at my age, spring is still a surprise. I was walking through town today. It's an absolutely exquisite day. Mm. Beautiful. Sun shining through the mist. It's an absolute delight. And then there'll be the boring summer, which I'll kill by writing a Benjamin Black book. And then the autumn will come, which is the great season for working in.
Do you have a name for your new book?
Well, I'm thinking of calling it Dark Matter, but I think that's becoming a cliche by now, so I don't know.
Well, when it comes out, we'll speak to you again.
I remember when I was doing a book of mine called Shroud, and my dear beloved friend Caroline Walsh, late Caroline Walsh, asked me the title, and I said, well, it's called Shroud, Caroline. And she said, oh, John, why don't you go the whole hog and call it Coffin? So Dark Matter is a nice, lightsome title.
Well, John Bamble with Roberto Colasso. You're going to be in the O'Reilly Theatre on Wednesday, May the 22nd next at 6 p.m. The website is ilfdublin.com. As ever, it was a privilege to talk to you, John Bamble, and happy Easter.
And happy Easter to you, and a pleasure to talk to you, Miriam.
Thank you, John. Well, Ruby Wax is now probably almost as well known for her work on mental health as she is for her acting and her documentaries and her great wit. She was awarded an OBE for her work on mental health and has spoken openly about her own struggles. She's just on her way to Ireland with her show, How to Be Human, and she joins me now from London. Good morning, Ruby Wax.
Hello, hello.
Thanks so much for joining us.
I like my intro.
Good.
Yeah.
Listen,
thank you.
The show.
Nobody in America knows what an OBE is.
Do they not?
No, I said I have an OBE and they think it's some kind of infection. And look at me with pity. Anyway, go ahead. It's your show.
You should tell them. Do you not boast and tell them what it is?
I don't really know what the letters stand for, so I get confused.
Okay.
I get confused, yeah. I say something about being obedient to the Queen and then they just laugh at me.
Well, look, your show, Ruby, How to Be Human, the manual, you're bringing it to Ireland, of course, you're on the way. What is it about? For people listening, you're going to Cork, Dublin and Belfast. What is the show about?
Well, I always wanted to know. To me, it's the most interesting thing. What makes us us? And, you know, I have all these questions. How do you choose the partner you choose? You know, what is addiction? And I don't mean to, you know, alcohol and drugs. I mean, how come I can't get off the internet at 2 o'clock in the morning and I'm chasing a lampshade? All these questions, like there seems to be something running me rather than me running it. And I'm always obsessed with, you know, how these thoughts happen. You know, we're so evolved. We make all this, you know, great eye candy. And yet the thoughts are always giving us bad reviews. And in the second half of the show, and also who helped me write the book, is a monk and a neuroscientist. And in the second half, they come out, and every question that I kind of took the piss out of and was, you know, I love Bill Bryson, so I take a fact and then I'll spin it because it's a comedy show. They're very funny, too, but they'll answer everything. You know, the monk understands the mind, and the neuroscientist says where it is in the mind. And I always say that since we've been doing these shows, the monk has become impossible.
What do you mean by that?
Well, he's getting very show busy.
Ooh.
You know, he's insisting on private hairstylists. He's bald. But, no, we love each other very much. We've been together 2 years.
Where did you find him?
I found the monk. He was...
he's a Buddhist monk, isn't he?
He's a Buddhist monk, but his mother's a famous comedian. She's on EastEnders, and she's the one in the Kumars, you know, who isn't Mira Sayal, I forget her name. But he's very funny, and he's English. And I saw him at a conference, and I thought he was so the friendly face of mindfulness, and he's funny. So I said, would you come and live in my house? And he tours the world most of the time. But I thought, how cool is that to have a monk in your house? It's like having a, you know, a scented candle. So he comes downstairs, and he's the same color as my sofa. So I like, you know, people come over and they just see the head. And he, you know, he's funny and he's smart. So him and the neuroscientist are a great double act.
And who's the neuroscientist?
The show isn't about them. It's about me. Okay.
Fine. Who's your neuroscientist, Ruby?
The neuroscientist is, he's good looking, but let's not say that because it's gone to his head too. And he's a neuroscientist and a neurologist and a microbiologist. He's one of those geniuses. He teaches at Yale, and he's one of those geniuses that doesn't have to look anything up. So I'll say, well, Ash, what's thoughts? You know, where are they? What do they look like? And he'll answer it. And I say, what are you looking at on your computer? And he's buying a lawnmower. He doesn't have to look anything up. And he's good to have around because every day I have a disease and I can report it to him and he can give me an instant diagnosis.
Is it because of your own mental health struggles? Is that when you became really interested in the mind and the brain? I mean, is that where that stems from, Ruby?
Well, no. I mean, I don't understand what's as interesting. You know, Brian Cox always points at the... You know, how long, many light years it takes to get to Jupiter. I don't need to know that. but I really want to know what makes me tick and what makes everybody else tick. I just, it's my favorite subject. It always was. And I think, listen, there's people who have mental illness and don't have mental illness and, you know, and they're chiropractors and they don't, you know, don't have back trouble. I would really defend it. What's more interesting than how you think? And I'm doing a show where I explain why we're, that we are not our fault. You know, certain things happened that really worked for us hundreds of thousands of years ago, but our little brain doesn't realize it's not the Stone Age. And so it doesn't know that the wallpaper's changed. So it's trying as hard as it can. And I find it really positive to know, to somebody to say, you know, it's not your nature, it's human nature. We're all pretty much the same. And the show makes you feel better. And it made me feel better when I research it, is to say, you know, and there's a very funny bit. I do a very beautiful dance, my dance of relationships. And, you know, my facts are real facts. It's just that I spin them a little bit, so they're funny. You know, the fact that we're, 98% of our DNA is shared with great apes, 25% is shared with yeast, and 18% of our DNA is shared with bananas, so get over yourself.
Do you think that's a great mix, though? If you mix, I suppose, humor, I mean, you're a comedian, that was originally, first and foremost, what you were. If you mix that with, well, I suppose, something serious about mental health, that's a good way of doing it.
I'm not talking about mental health. Let's, you know, this is why okay. There's a stigma. Mental health, what do you mean? You know, we're all mentally something, you know. Do you mean mental illness? Because mental health just means, you know, do you say somebody's physically healthy?
No. Good point. No, that's a good point.
So what do you say? You know, I'm talking about relationships, evolution, the future, and, you know, all the things that I find, you know, how does our brain work? And how does our mind work? And then what can we do about it? It's nothing to do with, if you're insinuating mental illness, this is not the show. Nor is my mental state have anything to do with what my interest is. You know, I happen to be mentally ill, but it's not all the time. And I wouldn't be able to go on tour if I was really sick.
Okay, that's actually really interesting. So in other words, the fact that you've spoken at length, Ruby, about depression and stuff, that's not why you wrote this book or are doing this show.
Not at all. I mean, look, I was a great canoeist once. I'm not talking about canoeing anymore. And then I did interviews with, you know, Donald Trump. Well, I do talk about that, but I don't do that anymore. And then you write a show and a book on a theme, well, then you go on to the next one. Otherwise, it's a very short-lived career. In my personal life, I do a lot for, you know, I've started Frazzle Cafes. I think they're coming to Ireland, which is in partnership with Marks and Spencer's, and small groups of 15 meet with a facilitator, and it's free coffee and cookies in Marks and Spencer's, and then they meet every 2 weeks. It's a lot like AA. But again, it's not for mentally ill people. We live in a world where we can't be honest with each other, you know, because we're supposed to be perfect. And I think, where'd we get that idea to be perfect? We're supposed to be flawed. We're supposed to be. Where did we get this idea? Because it's just torture. So I've created a room where people can speak human to each other and not have to ask, what is your child doing? Because I really don't care. It's life is hard enough. I just want to be real with people. And so that's my interest.
Do you think we put the pressure on ourselves about that, or society in general puts pressure on people to be perfect? Where does that come from?
I was trying to think of that. I mean, we had enough to worry about during the Spanish Inquisition, you know, so that was, those were tougher times. But nobody ever died of stress in the past. They died of old age and a spike through their head. And old age, I mean, about 12 and a half. But they didn't die of stress. So this new thing is something, again, it's not your fault. You know, we're really good at building tools and technology, but emotionally, we haven't really matured. And that's not your fault. It's just the way we're made. You know, evolution only cares about your survival. It really doesn't care about your happiness. You know, how you feel doesn't ensure your life or death situation, but how much fight and flight you can turn on, which is in this society, it's on all the time because there's not a predator there. But things like social media make you feel not part of the tribe, comparison, envy. It's all bumped up because it's in our face. And that's why I think we're ill, because we're getting stressed about stress. and then we're ashamed because we know we're not in a war zone. And so all these negative things play in our heads. But again, I think it's so great to know that this is everybody. Well, there, I mean, there are some people who are really resilient, but they don't usually buy my books.
That's all so interesting, actually. I watched your Who Do You Think You Are, Ruby. And, you know, some of my listeners may have seen it, some may not, because obviously it was on British television. You travelled to Vienna and then the Czech Republic, I think, and you discovered, I think, amazing things about your parents you hadn't known before. Would you mind telling my listeners a little bit about
them? It's in the show. I do talk about it. The last chapter I wrote when I was writing my book was forgiveness, but I'm not a, it's not my remit, forgiveness. My drug of choice is revenge. But I wrote it because I thought, oh, well, that'll commission the book. But at the same time I wrote out the chapters, the people from Who Do You Think You Are came over and said, can we do your story? But I didn't even know I had any relatives. So a year later, when I was writing that chapter, luckily they did my show. So I had something to write about because I knew nothing about my parents. And then it was a journey into really, literally madness. I do talk about it in the show, you know, that they hold up pictures of relatives, and I keep thinking they were great actresses because I'm under the illusion I come from a long line of great actresses. But they kept saying, no, they're insane. And the journey is visiting there where they were locked up. So I forgive all of them because, you know, they had even more shame than I do. And I'm proud of them in a way. But it's good to know where you come from. I always say, 1 year of genealogy is better than 50 years of therapy because it makes sense.
When you got to know your parents' story, I mean, do you mind telling my listeners just a little bit about them? They'd left in 1938, hadn't they?
Yeah. Well, they were the last ones out of Vienna. And my dad said he was an aerobics teacher in a gym, in jail. He always told me that, which I thought was weird. They said, no, he wasn't an aerobics teacher, that they were kind of... the Nazis were making the Jews jump up and down.
And they were Jewish, of course, them. Your parents, Ruby, weren't they?
Yeah. I wasn't raised that way, but they were. And so my dad was probably helping people up off the ground. And he told me he was an aerobics teacher. And then he got out of Vienna in a way that the guy, the historian, said, I've never heard this before, that he, first of all, took an airplane. The guy's poor. So how do you get on an airplane? And then he, that was just to Belgium, and then he escaped by stowing away on a ship. So the guy said, you know, the historian said, how did your father do that? How did he get on the ship? And then how did he get off the ship? So, you know, I understand where I get my push, is that I always have to be in the front of the queue because my dad, you know, really stepped on it through his life and was furious. And so I get it now.
But they never told you their story, did they, when they were alive? Did they, Ruby?
No, nothing. Nothing was mentioned. Everything was in the attic when they died. There was in the attic, which I wasn't allowed into. I was forbidden. There was a suitcase, and it had all this stuff in it. So Who Do You Think You Are had a heyday.
And did it make you understand them more? Because I don't think you had the happiest relationship with your mom, did you?
No, it was a terrible relationship. But the people that I found out who they were, you know, she was a serious-looking woman. I didn't know she was that beautiful, and she was really educated. I didn't know... I knew she was smart, but I didn't realize how beautiful she was. And she was 18 or something and had to leave. And then she hated America. She was really pissed off she had to go there. She used to say they were wild Indians. She'd go woo, 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 woo to people on the street. She hated it. And so I didn't know that woman. I didn't know her as an 18-year-old. I knew somebody else. But if I picture that somebody else being 18, then I'm sad. Because she never mentioned anything. And had she mentioned it, I would have forgiven her. But things happen, you know.
And when you...
Have you hung up on me?
No. I'm just okay. Really interested. And when you found out about her, and I suppose your dad, did it change your view of them?
Oh, of course it did. But as I say, that's not who I grew up with. So I can still be really funny about them because their lines were out of this world. You know, it was just pure insanity. But that has nothing to do with the war. It really doesn't. They were really eccentric.
Were they proud at all of your success?
I can't tell. You know, they'd say, oh, this is kook stuff. Everybody's laughing at you, not with you, Kobe. This is insane. But then I heard each show, like The Milkman in Chicago, my picture's on the front of a magazine. So it was a peculiar thing.
We discussed your OBE at the very beginning, which you got for your services to mental health. And you, I think you've got a master's in mindfulness-based cognitive therapy as well, don't you?
Yeah, I do. I got it a few years ago. I was interested again in the brain, and so they were teaching that the results of mindfulness and cognitive therapy, what happens in the brain, and I was always interested in not mental health, but what happens in the one organ that for some reason, if it gets ill, nobody sends you a sympathy card. So I was interested in the brain, and so they were teaching that at Oxford, and some miraculous reason I got in. My friends always go, how'd you get in the Royal Shakespeare Company and how'd you get into Oxford? And they think it's as much a mystery as who shot Kennedy.
No. Well, look, Ruby Wax, your show, How to Be Human, your live show, is going to be the Cork Opera House on the 29th of April, the National Concert Hall in Dublin, 2nd of May, and the Ulster Hall in Belfast on the 5th of May. As ever, thanks so much for chatting to us this morning,
Thank
Ruby.
You. And Ireland's my favourite place to tour. In the world.
Do you
I'm
say
so
that
excited.
To all countries?
No, I don't. It's Ireland. Okay. Why do I keep asking to go back? Those okay. are my favourite, because they're the smartest.
Okay, great. We'll take that compliment, Ruby, and delighted you're coming back.
Thank you.
Take
Thanks.
Care.
Bye-bye.
I'm joined again now by Luca Bloom. Morning, Luca.
Good morning again.
You sang beautifully for us earlier, that song, Diamond Mountain, you wrote. You go, and it's connected with Australia. You just come back from Australia. You love Australia,
I
don't
do,
you?
I do, yeah, I do. Beyond just the joy of doing the gigs, I've loved Australia. I love being there. I really like the people there. I call them Paddies with suntans. They're just, they have this dark sense of humour that I really love. They love the outdoors. The ocean, of course, is beautiful. And I meet so many Irish people. I meet Australians who look like Irish people. I just love the place. I love going back.
Now, you're going to sing another song for us now called Gangster's Paradise on this Easter Sunday morning. Tell me about this.
Well, from a song that I wrote 25 years ago to a song I've been singing in my kitchen for the last number of months, and I just thought for fun it would be lovely to try it this morning, and I'm really, you know, happy that you guys are open to that. So thank you, because it's a bit scary for me to try something. And I just came out of the cinema there the other night, having watched that beautiful film, The Wild Rose, starring the incredible young Jessie Buckley.
Yeah.
And there were elements about it that were really rough and gritty and to do with drugs and alcohol and all kinds of stuff. And when I came out of the cinema, as I was walking through Stony Batter and walking up along the quays, I saw lots of young people dealing, and it just kind of broke my heart. And I just felt connection to this song again. It's on the surface, it's a very dancey, cool kind of a song, but lyrically, it's actually quite sad. And I really love the song.
Great. Let's listen to it now.
As I walk through the valley in the shadow of death, I take a look at my life and see there's nothing left. I've been blasting and laughing so long. Even my mother thinks my mind is gone. I never seen a man who didn't deserve it treat me like a punk, that is unheard of. Watch how you talk and where you walk, or you and yours might be lined in chalk. I really hate to trip, but I have to low, cause they croak, I see myself in the pistol smoke. I'm the kind of guy the little ones wanna be like, on my knees in the night saying prayers in the streetlight. We're spending most our lives living in a gangster's paradise. We're spending most our lives living in a gangster's paradise. Look at the situation they've got me facing. I can't live a normal life raised on the street. I've gotta get down with my team, cause television's got me chasing dreams. I'm an educated fool with money on my mind, a ten in my hand and a gleam in my eye. A loked out gangster, set trippin' banger. My team is down, do not arouse my anger, cause death is just a heartbeat away. I'm living life, do or die, what can I say? I'm 23 now, will I see 24? The way things are going, I just don't know.
And how are we so blind to see that the ones we hurt are you and me? Been spending most our lives living in a gangster's paradise. We're spending most our lives living in a gangster's paradise. The power and the money and the power, minute after minute, hour after hour. Everybody's running, nobody's looking what goes on in the kitchen. I don't know what's cooking, they say I gotta learn. Nobody's here to teach me if they don't understand. How can they reach me? I guess they can't, I guess they won't, I guess they front. That's how I know my life is out of love. And how are we so blind to see that the ones we hurt are you and me? Been spending most our lives living in gangster's paradise. We're spending most our lives living in a gangster's paradise. We're spending most our lives living in a gangster's paradise. We're spending most our lives living in a gangster's paradise.
That's a great song, but it's an old song. Is it that song, Gangster's Paradise?
I think the original version of that song was written by Stevie Wonder, and Coolio then did a version of it, like, in the 90s. And there's a lovely feeling to the way he sings it. It's very groovy, but I just wanted to do a very soft version of it that really brought out the lyrics.
Easter Sunday, does it mean much to you?
What I love about Easter is this. I just love I love beginnings, and Easter to me feels like a beginning. It feels like spring has truly arrived. I've so many friends in Ireland who are very strong Catholic people, and I really admire and respect them. It's just not my path. I try and bring a sense of nature or a sense of the poetry of the occasion to it. My relationship with all that stuff around Good Friday and Easter has changed completely in the last 20 or 30 years. And now I just try and see the nature in it and the goodness in it and the goodness in people. And there's something very childlike about Easter Sunday. I tend to, as somebody said to me the other day, I just fast forward to the chocolates.
And of course, when you were growing up, I assume your mum would have been quite religious, would she, I mean, or not?
Not really, actually.
Okay,
no, she was a very unusual woman in that regard. I think she would have been earlier on in her life, but I think as time went on and as she would say herself, she was politically schooled in a way by her, certainly to a large extent, her daughters. I've heard her say that. I think she distanced herself more from the church because I think she felt, as we now rightly know, that the church wasn't an entirely kind place for women. And so she wasn't actually. I don't ever remember her telling me to go to Mass.
Interesting. And maybe unusual.
In the 60s.
Yeah.
She was an unusual woman. She was...
Strong.
She was a very strong woman. She had to be a strong woman, yeah.
Because she was widowed young, of course.
She was indeed.
How many of you were there?
I was the youngest of six.
Were you spoiled rotten by her? Be honest.
Guilty as charged.
You're going to go out and sing another song for us now. And also, you're doing a good few shows next month, I know, with friends, The Fiddle Case.
The Fiddle Case are friends of mine, Owen and Adam and Jono and Kieran. They're just lads. I love to play with. They're a great band, but I love to play with them. We hang out together a lot in Clare, and we play sessions together around Clare from time to time. And so we're doing some shows together. They put out an album last year. I put out a little album last year, a live album from a radio show I did in Bremen in 2001. And I never even knew it. The file still existed. And a German record company released it last year. So we're having a little joint celebration in Glore.
In Ennis,
in the Spirit Store in Dundalk. And in...
DeBarra's, I think.
DeBarra's in Clonakilty.
Yeah.
And prior to that, I'm going up north next week.
And where are you going north?
I'm going to Limavady, to an arts centre there. I'm going to Seamus Heaney's home place in Ballaghy, which I'm really excited about. And one of my favourite gigs in Ireland is the Black Box in Belfast. So home to busy times, and it's a beautiful thing.
Do you love and enjoy performing as much today as you did when you began?
Much more so. It's finally, in the last couple of years only, dawned on me, Miriam, that maybe the people who buy tickets to see me play aren't complete idiots. And I think I've gotten a bit more relaxed about the way that I am in my gigs. And because I've been writing for 45 years and learning songs for 45 years, I have a lot of songs to choose from. I don't make out a set list. And because of the age I'm at, I'm a lot closer to my last show than I am to my first one. And so every time I get to walk on a stage and sing for some people, it's an immense privilege. And I know how blessed I am to have the job I have, and I really appreciate it.
Well, that's a great way to approach life, isn't it? It's very positive.
I hope so. I mean, I think this is what I'll finally say about Easter. I want every day to be Easter. I want to wake up every morning, not just Easter Sunday, and feel that sense of redemption and renewal. I fancy the idea of having that every single day of my life. I think anybody can have that. It doesn't have to be saved for special days like this.
That's a really beautiful thought to leave us with on Easter Sunday. And you're going to sing one more song for us. What are you going to sing?
Thank you, Miriam. Thank you so much. A song my mother would have loved, and a song I've grown to love, called My Wild Irish Rose.
Oh, well, Luca Bloom, happy Easter.
Happy Easter to you.
And thanks so much for coming in. We'll chat soon.
Thank you, Miriam.
Off you go. Get ready to sing. Thank you for listening on this Easter Sunday. My thanks on sound to Ruth Kennington, to my producer, Sian O'Gorman. And we'll go out listening to Luca Bloom and The Wild Irish Rose.
If you listen, I'll sing you a sweet little song of a flower that's now drooped and dead, yet dearer to me than all of its mates, though each holds aloft its proud head. It was given to me by a girl that I love. Since I met her, I've known no repose. She is dearer by far than the world's brightest star. And I call her my wild Irish rose. My wild Irish rose. The sweetest flower that grows. You may search everywhere, but none will compare to my wild Irish rose. My wild Irish rose. The dearest flower that grows. Let me take the bloom from my wild Irish rose. They may sing of their roses, which by other name would smell just as sweetly, they say. But I know that my rose would never consent to have that sweet name taken away. Her glances are shy whene'er I pass by the bower where my true love repose. And my one wish has been that someday I might win the heart of my wild Irish rose. My wild Irish rose. The sweetest flower that grows. You may search everywhere, none will compare to my wild Irish rose, my wild Irish rose, thy dearest flower that grows. Someday for my sake she may let me take the bloom from my wild Irish rose. My wild Irish rose.